Hey y'all, how's it going? Good, good. Or put on another jacket then. Anyway, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. And my microphone is plugged in, so that's a good way to start this show. Yeah. All right. So, man, I'm all excited. I get to go and see all my virtual friends there in Washington, D.C. John Glazer's going to be there, and I get to hang out with Bumper Hornberger and Sheldon Richmond and Bob Higgs again, and I get to meet Michael Swanson in person, the author of The War State and the operator, author of WallStreetWindow.com. So that'll be really cool. And then supposedly Phil Giraldi and Dan McAdams are supposed to show up on Saturday. Gareth Porter's going to be there. Did I already say Gareth Porter? Gareth Porter's going to be there. I love hanging out with Gareth Porter, man. That guy's my hero. And he's got his new book, Manufactured Crisis, about Iran's nuclear program. So hell yeah. And cool. Now, the problem is all of this precipitation, the frozen kind, it seems to really be putting a damper on everything according to the TV over there and all that. So, I don't know. Some people's flights are canceled. I know that Angela Keaton and Nick Hancock were supposed to leave L.A. today, and their flight has been canceled, and they can't seem to arrange one for tomorrow. So it doesn't look like they're going to be able to make it. I hope I didn't just dissuade anyone who was only coming to see Nick. Or Angela. But anyway. Many of our flights are not canceled. I mean, they say that the whole weather thing is supposed to be over today. Tomorrow should be okay again. And, you know, last-ditch effort. Maybe people can fly in Saturday morning, that kind of thing. I don't know. But it's the International Students for Liberty Conference at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Washington, D.C. And the Future Freedom Foundation is having myself and John Glazer give a talk on libertarianism versus the empire. And so, you know, I'm going to try to do, I mean, really, it's only one radio segment worth of talking time. And that ain't much. You know me. So, I think basically my plan is to tackle the whole terror war and the empire at the same time. And yeah, so the challenge is getting that done in one kind of 15-minute thing. I'll have to begin working on that. I've jotted down a few notes, but I better get my act together and be prepared to get up there and, you know, win the argument forever in one try. That's my goal. That's Saturday afternoon. John Glazer's going to talk about why anti-imperialism is at the center of libertarianism and must remain at the center of libertarianism for libertarianism to be libertarianism. So that's going to be really good, too. And then, man, Oliver Stone's going to be there, and Jeremy Scahill is going to be there. Yay, Scahill! This guy, man, he does great reporting. And not only that, but he's part of the new First Look Media Intercept project with Greenwald there. And, you know, it shouldn't be special, but it is, to have leftist, progressive, liberal types willing to criticize, you know, journalists, willing to really take on a Democratic president. And it shouldn't be unique at all, but it is. And in fact, you know, my first exposure to Scahill was back in the 1990s. He got right in Wesley, well, late 90s. He got right in Wesley Clark's face working for Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! And said, hey, man, you killed innocent civilians in Kosovo, murderer. So how do you account for that, pal? Right in front of a group of, you know, Wesley Clark, I don't know, Clarkies. Wesley Clark groupies, who knew there was such a thing, but there they were, and they all tried to shut Scahill down and block him and prevent him from asking his question, and Wesley Clark actually stopped them and said, nah, he's a reporter, he's asking questions, it's all right, and he didn't give a very good answer, but So Scahill, and then of course he became kind of a household name because of his great book about Blackwater back during the days of George W. Bush and all the attention that he brought to the mercenary forces being employed by, you know, the Cheney regime there. And then and he's stayed good, and he's done this great book. Many of y'all have seen the movie. I actually haven't seen the movie. But the book is Dirty Wars. The movie's got the same title. And the book is, I mean, he does cover the Bush years, but mostly it's the story of the drone war and the terror war in the Obama years. So some Afghanistan, but mostly Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, drone wars. And it's, but, you know, nothing on Syria or Libya in there, I don't think. But anyway, really good stuff. And by the way, man, I better write in my notes to mention, I'm going to have Francis Nesbitt on the show a little bit later, just a little bit later, to talk about America's proxy war in Somalia, low these many years now. And one of the things I have to remember to bring up during that interview is page 222 of Scahill's book, where he talks about how the whole regime change operation wasn't even ever really meant to be a regime change. They wanted to keep Sheikh Sharif after all. They just want to take him down a peg or two. And they got a quarter of a million people killed. Of course, the majority of those women and children, and the majority of those children. Because they wanted to take the leader down a peg over there in Somalia. So anyway, yeah, Francis Nesbitt will be on to talk about that war, but that's some of Scahill's reporting. And he'll be at this Students for Liberty thing. And then also Robert Higgs. Oh, Stephen Kinzer, the author of Overthrow and All the Shaw's Men, and the new one about the Dulles brothers will be there, and he's one hell of a speech giver, man. I guarantee you that's worth the $50 to see Kinzer talk about the Dulles brothers. And I haven't even read the book yet, so I don't even know what he has to say about the Dulles brothers. But I know what I've got to say about the Dulles brothers, and it would make a great book. So I'm sure, you know, Kinzer's book is way better than anything I could have come up with, and I'm sure his speech is a hell of a lot better than I could have ever given too. So I can't wait to see that. That's going to be great. And then Jonathan Turley, he's really good in person, man. You may see him on MSNBC or whatever, being a civil libertarian from time to time, but I've seen him give a speech on the Fourth Amendment before at a FFF function, actually, back in 08, and he was great, man, all about, the ratchet effect when it comes to eroding the Bill of Rights, decision by decision by decision, you know, crime by cop upheld after crime by cop upheld. Good stuff there. And then, yeah, of course, I think I mentioned Higgs, Orenberger, Richmond, FFF All-Stars. And then at the larger Students for Liberty conference, Jeffrey Tucker's going to be there, and I forget who else. I mentioned him yesterday. But the whole thing's going to be badass, man. So if you like people giving speeches about things, speeches about libertarianism and stuff, that's right. Show up in D.C. this weekend if you can. If your flight ain't canceled, if your truck's tires are big enough, then we'll see you in D.C. at the Grand Hyatt all day Saturday and Sunday, I guess it is, for the International Students for Liberty Conference. Hooray. Boy, I really better get to work on that thing. It's already Thursday. I'm going to be up all night. All right. Yeah. Also, did I mention? I didn't mention. Let me mention. Andy Worthington's going to be on the show today. Yay, Andy. Good old Andy Worthington, man. You know, he's America's best guy we've got on Guantanamo, and he's a Brit. And we've got some good people on Guantanamo, but Andy Worthington, well, he's one of them. And he writes at andyworthington.co.uk, and he is a FFF guy, in fact, a Future Freedom Foundation guy himself. Has written numerous articles for them. I don't know if he has a title there or whatever, but he certainly writes for the Future Freedom regularly. And he's great, and he's going to be on to talk all about what's going on at Guantanamo Bay. This is not a rerun. This is, well, it could be, I guess, maybe when somebody ends up hearing it. But damn it, right now, while I'm yelling it, it's live. The 13th of February, 2014. And yeah, we're going to get an update on the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay from Andy Worthington later on the show. The Scott Horton Show here on the Liberty Express. LibertyExpressRadio.com, ScottHorton.org, RonPaulRadio.com. Hang tight, back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Andy Worthington and Francis Nesbitt coming up a little bit later on the show. Now, I have to attack Rand Paul a little bit here. I appreciate the fact that he's done this class action suit against the National Security Agency for bugging all our phones. The Fourth Amendment's the law, simple as that. In fact, it's an amendment, which means any part of any of the prior articles of the Constitution, which you could have possibly tried to pervert into saying the government can get away with what they're getting away with. Fourth Amendment trumps all that. End of argument. You can't do it. You don't have the authority to do it. So Rand Paul is suing him, and that's good. But then... And now, I don't care about the controversy about Bruce Fine, you know, this bogus controversy, not even a controversy. Never mind that, the Bruce Fine thing. But in the story, the Washington Post story about the Bruce Fine thing about, so he wrote the lawsuit and then somebody said he didn't get paid enough, but then he said, yeah, he did. So, right, again, it doesn't matter. It's not a thing. But the point is that the Washington Post story about that includes the fact that they had a Democrat senator signed on to the lawsuit. So it's going to be this awesome kind of, transpartisan alliance, bipartisan, rally for the Bill of Rights, principle first, save Amendment 4 kind of a thing. And instead, they kicked the senator off of the lawsuit and put Freedom Works on there, which is, I guess, a libertarian organization, but sort of a right libertarian, Tea Party-ish sort of a kind of thing. I don't know all about it. But as far as them taking Fine's name off of the suit, I don't really, it's never mind any personal stuff between Rand and Bruce Fine, who cares? But the point is that I would always want to put that guy forward, because you talk about giving a speech. That guy could walk into the Supreme Court and wreck him. I mean, he's badass. He has everything that James Madison ever said completely memorized. All of it. And so, no matter what any horrible person has to say to justify anything, he will go, yeah, well, James Madison said once, blam, 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 and whoop. And it's always a good one, right? It's not just that it's Madison who said it, argument from authority, it's correct, but it also comes from the guy who is the principal author of the U.S. Constitution in the first place. And so, I mean, he's a force to be reckoned with, man. That same conference where I saw the Kinzer speech, I saw Bruce Fine's speech, and he was supposed to go for 45 minutes, and he went for an hour and 45 minutes. It was ridiculous. I mean, the audience is dying out there, including maybe especially me. And they're like holding up cards. Enough! Somebody get the hook and like Bugs Bunny thing, Elmer Fudd, and yank him off the stage. And anyway, But he was great. I mean, he could just, that guy could filibuster. Boy, if he was a senator, Bruce Fein, look out, dude. He would filibuster everything every day. And so I would want to have him on my lawsuit. That's all I'm saying. Any, you know, personal decision to disinclude him or whatever the hell was a big mistake. If anybody made it, I don't know or care about that. But what I don't like is taking something that is, I admit, political. I told you yesterday, I could be wrong about this, but I don't think so. I don't think that a court is going to let this go very far anyway. Maybe it'll get to the appeals court level or something, but at some point a federal court is going to say, you know what, Senator, this is between you and your body and the president, not us. This is a matter of national security. You write the law. You know, we assume the president's doing the right thing on matters of national security. You want to curb his activity? Go ahead and curb it. Leave us out of it. I guarantee you that's what they're going to say. They're going to defer judgment on this suit. But that's all right. So it's political. It's a gigantic thing. It's a class action suit. Rand Paul's inviting every American to sign on to this thing. Brilliant. Perfect. I hope they do. Maybe I will. But the thing of it is that if he had a Democrat senator on there, that's political and bipartisan and trans-ideological and all of that kind of crap. Realignment-y, just how I like it. But then if he goes ahead and makes it just a partisan Republican thing, then that makes it just a partisan Republican thing. He was suing the Pentagon and the NSA. Now he's suing Obama. So that, you know, he can try to get Rush Limbaugh on board or whatever kind of crap. Too bad. I don't know, man. I'd probably make too much of it, but it just seems like it seems like a perfectly stupid way to undermine the whole point and the possibility of it really being successful. How are you going to get the idea right in the first place was to get all the Daily Coast kids to sign it too, right? For everyone to join this class action suit. Give them some of their political heroes that they like and have them sign on to the thing. And then, you know, it'll be like, this is one good thing we all do have in common. Gotta give you credit, other side, for being good on this. But instead, no, you're not invited. This is a, you know, fringe of the Republican Party project only. Great. I don't think I will sign up now. And I ain't no Daily Coast kid. Anyway, that's my take on that. It was political. Now it's just partisan. I mean, maybe it's not too late. But that's the way it seems to me. And partisan ain't going to get you very far there, bud. Not on this. All right. Now, here's another thing. So I see this thing. I like talking about stuff like this. Not that I'm smart enough to write a book about it or anything like that, but... well, I'm interested in it is all, basically. That's all I have. McClatchy Marist poll. American dream seen as out of reach. So, I mean, what a bunch of nonsense anyway, right? But... basically, the American dream is the idea that, you know, you do at least a little bit better than your parents. They work hard so that you have the advantage. You can do a little bit better than them. Go to college, be a professional, own a piece of property, you know, maybe own your own business, become part of the great American middle class, all of that stuff, right? If you ever get accused of something, probably get something resembling a fair trial in a way. All that American dream stuff. Well, people don't believe in it anymore. Well, they want to believe in it. They just don't, you know, they know better than to have faith that it's going to happen to them. It doesn't seem like it. And I'm sure the younger you get, the more pessimistic too, since you have all these people coming of age right in the middle of this horrible recession and all these people, you know, loaded above their eyebrows with student debt and nobody hiring and all of that. I mean, you look at the unemployment numbers for the young, they're way higher than for for everybody else, which is already pretty bad. And there's a lot of underemployment and all that, too. And the thing of it is, but there's cheap credit everywhere, Scott. So how come everybody isn't feeling all high? I thought all the government had to do was just print money and push that rope out there into the economy, and the people will start tugging on it. It'll be great. And yet instead, see, this is the thing about it, man, is, you know, you're living, you're standing or sitting on top of a country right now that's an entirely different place than what it would be if only we didn't have the empire. It's the empire that ruined your damn American dream that you want so bad. That's where all the money went, killing people. Stop pretending that you don't know that. They spent, well, it was $8 trillion 2 years ago. It's got to be near 10 now on the national security state, the wars, homeland security, etc. Veterans benefits for the maimed since September 11th. Somewhere right around $8, $9, $10 trillion. I mean, when I interviewed Chris Hellman, it was 2 years ago, it was $8 trillion. So round up to whatever you like. Round down. Let's say they haven't spent another cent since then. How do you like that? $8 trillion. And if you ever read 1984, which they say is the second most popular book by British author in America ever, has been read by more Americans than any other book than The Fellowship of the Ring, written by a Brit anyway, you might remember that when the evil torturer is pretending to be our hero Winston Smith's friend for a little while, he gives him the book on this is how we do it to him. And what he says in there is that the permanent war is the way to keep everybody off balance, to keep them desperate, to keep them loyal, to take all of their excess wealth from all of their productive capacity, blast it off into space on one of their fancy new rockets, or sink it into the ocean in the form of their new floating fortress aircraft carriers. To keep that money from the people where they might better be able to spend it improving their own lives, their own selves, their own society. That was the point of it all, according to George Orwell, and that sure as hell is the effect of it here. So when you're standing in the unemployment line, just remember that's your price. That's your tax for the war in Iraq, for Somalia, for Libya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Mali. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. Follow me on, like me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter. Subscribe to me on YouTube at @ScottHortonShow. All right, first guest today is Francis Nesbitt, and he is at the Department of Africana Studies at San Diego State University. And he's got book chapters and articles in, Foreign Policy and Focus and 10 other journals around the world as well. Welcome back to the show, Francis. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. There are very few people who can speak well on America's intervention, Western intervention in Somalia, you know, over the last few years, and I was very impressed by what you had to say when we spoke before, so I really appreciate you being available for us today. I guess the recent word is that Ethiopia has now, is it re-invaded Somalia? And then is that at the behest of the United States again?
Yes, Ethiopia has, its troops have been integrated into AMISOM, which is a African Union mission in Somalia, which is funded by the United States and other Western nations. And so, in a way, yes, they are working at the behest of the United States foreign policy. So, yes, so since the 2006 invasion, the first invasion at the behest of the Bush administration was in 2006. They were forced to leave in 2009. Now, but since then, the main point is that they have been unofficially within Somalia. So what they've done is just made it official. You know, they say 4,300 and some troops are going to be integrated into the AMISOM force. Well, we know that there have been more than 4,000 troops from Ethiopia inside Somalia over the last few years. So they have had many incursions into Somalia territory. So what they've done now is just made it official.
I see. So it's not really a re-invasion. This is still the re-invasion because they did leave right after 2008 and then they came back, what, 2 or 3 years ago, correct? Or
right,
they really
right.
have been there all along?
Yes, exactly. They've been there all along. They've been operating there. The United States is operating a drone base within Ethiopia. That's where the drone attacks come from. And so they've been involved for a long time. In fact, even the troop numbers we are being given by the United Nations of 4,395 seem a little low. So they have been there for a while. And so what is happening now is that by being integrated into AMISOM, they're following the example of Kenya. You know, it's Kenya which invaded Somalia and then a year later in 2011 was integrated into AMISOM. And that means that they will have funding. That is, instead of them funding Ethiopia or Kenya, funding the operations within Somalia, it is now funded by the United Nations.
Mm. All right. Now, I guess, well, let's talk about the most important thing really first is, I guess, the weather and the state of the crops and the famine
right.
there. Is how over is it?
Well, it's... it's famine time again, and there's a lot of difficulty. And there seems to be some problems in Al-Shabaab-controlled areas within Somalia, where, you know, as you know, recently they expelled various international NGOs. And so this is as we talked about, I think, was it last year we talked about when the same similar thing happened? This is the serious problem here in the sense that aid operations are not able, well, first of all, there's a drought, so people are not able to, this is the time when they plow the land in order to seed it, and if they're not able to do that, there'll be a disaster within 3 months or so. So it's unfortunate that the conflict is going on right now, which is hindering humanitarian operations. So this is going to have a major impact if the international community doesn't take action now.
Yeah, well, I guess it was last spring or early last summer that FuseNet,
yeah.
which is, I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's an American and British sponsored, you know, so-called NGO type organization that monitors famines around the world. And
mm-hmm.
They said that, approximately, their measure was 260,000 Somalis had died in the famine, and then the majority of
right.
those were children under the age of 5, they said.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's There have been these reports over the years. It's, you know, the farmers have to be able to plow the land at a particular time in anticipation of the rains. And if conflict blocks that that operation, it becomes, you know, it's a disaster, but it is a disaster that is predictable.
Right.
Right. So the part of the support for Ethiopia and for AMISOM comes from some of these organizations that think that if they could stabilize the situation in time, then it might be possible to avert another major disaster that has occurred last year.
Mm. Well, it's certainly true that the war, I mean, I guess, you know, in 2010 and 11, the whole Horn of Africa was hit with the bad weather, but the famine hit Somalia the hardest because, as you said, the instability, the inability for, you know, farmers to just go out and you know, sow their crops and then, for that matter, their ability to get them to market or anybody at the market to buy what they have to sell. I mean, the whole division of labor is completely destroyed in the war there, and certainly that's why it hit them so hard. So now, I guess you sound like you're saying that the situation is so bad that really probably the best bet for staving off another renewed famine of those kinds of numbers of dead would be for the outside interventionists, the Americans and the African Union, to win, basically, to get it together enough that they can really conquer the whole country, eliminate al-Shabaab and any of the conflict, you know, peace in total victory, and then maybe they'll be able to deliver some food aid. Is that really right? I mean, I would think that if we're the ones who made it this bad, maybe we should just knock it off.
It's not. The thing is that if it gets to the point, what I'm saying is, if, let's say, the farmers are not able to go and sow their crops this year, then it will get to a situation where the international community will be forced to intervene because there'll be mass starvation. Right? So, I mean, as we've discussed before, the issue in Somalia is how to develop a stable Somali state that can secure itself and take care of these kinds of issues. Mm. Right? That's the ultimate goal, to have the Somali military built up and the state built up to such a where they can actually take control of their territory.
Mm. Well, now, are they willing to negotiate with the al-Shabaab insurgency at all?
Excuse me?
Is the government in Mogadishu, are they willing to try to negotiate with the al-Shabaab insurgency, or their policy is just win or lose, keep fighting forever?
No, the Somali state has negotiated with factions of al-Shabaab. You know, al-Shabaab is not a monolithic entity. They have negotiated with factions. One of the leaders, Hassan Al-Waiz, last year actually defected from al-Shabaab to, and he has a strong militia, to the Somali government, and is cooperating with the Somali government currently. So, yes, they are willing to negotiate with certain factions. And as you know, the al-Shabaab itself has been weakened and fragmented since the Kenyan incursion into Kismayo. They lost their main source of funding, which is the port of Kismayo, where they, you know, ran smuggling operations. So what has happened is that the al-Shabaab has fractured, so that they are the internationalists under Modane, who is the current de facto leader of al-Shabaab. And then there are others who are nationalists who would like to take over the Somalia government. So this is the situation. There are certain factions which are willing to negotiate with the Somalia government, and those talks are ongoing. The other factions that are, for instance, the internationalists, who might not be interested in, you know, negotiations with the government, and, you know, so because their goals are different. So, so it's a fluid situation, politically.
Well, now, and when you talk about the internationalized, you mentioned last time that we spoke, that when the Kenyans took the port town of Mogadishu, that was their income was the charcoal business and all of that. And so they had to turn to outside donors to survive. But that came with changing their position about who exactly their enemy was. And that was what kind of internationalized them. So then do I read you right that that means Saudis?
Yes, certain Saudi-based groups, the Salafists and so on, not just Saudi, but you know, all over the Middle East and the world, there are groups that are willing to fund attacks on Westerners in East Africa. So, so they are appealing to those groups by attacking, for instance, Westgate Mall in Kenya. That is a fundraising exercise that is seeking support from these international organizations that are calling them internationalists, right? Whereas the traditional Islamists in Somalia were funded by local businessmen who, and of course the smuggling operations at Kismayo, not Mogadishu, by the way, it's Kismayo, the port that Kenyans took over. So this is, so there are various factions within Al-Shabaab. The internationalist one, is the one that conducted the attacks on Kenya, and it seems to be ascendant, at least within Somalia. Mm-hmm. At least that's where the funding is coming from. Whereas the nationalists have really lost the battle in Somalia.
Now we got to hold it right here and go out to this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Francis Nesbitt from the Department of Africana Studies at San Diego State University. And yeah, I'm sorry if I said Mogadishu when I meant Kismayo. I get that wrong. One time I said World War II ended in 1845, and I didn't even notice until the next day. We'll be right back after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. All right. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is my website. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. No, really. ScottHorton.org. And also you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right. We're in the middle of talking with Francis Nesbitt. He's a professor there in San Diego and an expert on the war still raging after all these years, or I don't know how raging it is, but it's still going on in Somalia there. And where we left off, we were talking about the split between the internationalists and the nationalists. But, you know, I'm curious, back, it would have been 2010 or 11, I think, there was an attack on a Ugandan, I guess, a restaurant where people were gathered around watching the soccer game on TV. And at the time, at least, my best understanding of that wasn't so much that Al-Shabaab had become an internationalized movement as much as this was direct revenge for the Ugandans shelling a soccer field outside of Mogadishu and killing a bunch of children of just a few weeks before. And they said, okay, well, we're going to bomb you back. And it was just a strict matter of blowback. But then I hear you cite the attack on the mall in Kenya as a real change in direction. So it must be more than just the act that makes you say that that's more than just revenge for what Kenya is doing in Somalia right now, but that it it marks a real change in their strategy, their plans for the future, that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. Since the Ugandan bombing, the Al-Shabaab has changed in character. The Ahmed Godane, who was a leader within Al-Shabaab earlier, has taken power. And Ahmed Godane is known to be an internationalist rather than a nationalist. That is, he eliminated his rivals within Al-Shabaab and has consolidated his power over the organization. At the same time, there's the other factor, which is the fact that they lost Kismayo, and they lost their major source of funding by losing Kismayo and a couple of other ports to the Kenyan forces. And so Al-Shabaab has, at least the official arm, has been forced to seek funding elsewhere, and the internationalist factions, which includes, by our reports, at least 100 international jihadists who are not particularly interested in taking over the Somali state, but are more interested in attacking Western targets in the region. You know, they are internationalists, and they are the ones now who are bringing in the funding. Right? Terrorism thrives on funding. You know, so these are the ones that funded the Westgate Mall attack, and this faction seems to be more ascendant in even within Somalia itself. So there is this split. And we saw that, as I mentioned earlier, with the defection of Hassan Awes to the Somali government. I mean, he gave himself up last year to the Somali government. He was a member of Al-Shabaab. He brings, he has a leader of a major clan militia. And so, you know, you can see this process where the pressure that has been put on Al-Shabaab has led to this internationalist faction being the dominant faction.
Right. Okay, now, this is sort of a two-parter about Somali public opinion, and I guess we're excluding Somaliland and Puntland from this, and we're just talking about, I guess, the rest of Somalia is really what's in question, right? And then, so the question is public opinion in favor of what Al-Shabaab is doing at all? And or it could be related, but it could be also sort of be a separate question of whether they support the so-called government in Somalia that the internationals have come in and, put in place there for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fluid situation. Al-Shabaab has made a bad name for itself by imposing extreme Sharia at the behest of their international donors, of course, the Wahhabis and so on, beheading people and stonings and amputations, banning music, banning movies and so on. And so there is that discontent with Al-Shabaab, especially in areas where they are not the clan leaders in those particular areas. At the same time, there is discontent with the government of Somalia, which also has its problems. It's unable to secure the country, and it's unable to provide any forms of services, you know, to its constituents. So it's a fluid situation. And this situation could change, and that's why this problem with current incursion of the Ethiopian troops into Somalia, its integration into AMISOM, could change. The situation could change people's minds, because Ethiopia is a traditional enemy. It's considered a Christian state. They've had the war, the Ogaden War in 1976-77, the 2006 invasion, and they have had it's a traditional enemy in the region. So this situation could lead to, in some areas, particularly the Ogaden area and in the Ogaden clan, to support further support for Al-Shabaab, right, because of these Ethiopian, the presence of Ethiopian troops within Somalia.
Right. Yeah, it's just another chapter in the same thing, the intervention making it all worse, creating this problem in the first place. I think if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is, just like we've seen in Iraq and just like we've seen in Syria, these, Sunni-based insurgents or, Al-Qaeda type guys, they wear out their welcome among the local population real quick when you know, they're nothing but an insurgency, and they act like they're already the dictatorship, and they just, you know, turn people against them. They marginalize themselves, but then here comes the cavalry to come right. and give people a reason to support them again in the form of Ethiopia's renewed invasion. I mean, this is how al-Shabaab grew up from nobody to somebody in the first place, was in the fight right. against the Ethiopians back in 2006 through 8, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, al-Shabaab emerged after the Ethiopian troops crushed the Islamic Coast Union. And then the militarized faction of the Islamic Coast Union was al-Shabaab. And this is its origin, that resentment of Ethiopian invasion. And, of course, it was a horrible mistake in 2006, the 2006 invasion, which was supported by the United States and the George Bush administration, because they destroyed the only credible structure that existed at the time in Mogadishu, that is a political structure, and then it led to the further radicalization of al-Shabaab and the emergence of al-Shabaab. So, yes, so this kind of cycle is, as you've just pointed out, quite prevalent around the world. You know, you invade, occupy a country, leads to resentment, and the terrorist groups count on that. You know, for instance, the Westgate Mall attack was designed to get the United Kenyan government and its allies in the U.S. and the West, so on, to overreact to this act and crack down on Somalis and other Muslims in Kenya, which leads to resentment and leads to possibly an insurgency within Kenya. You know, this is the strategy used by some of these groups, that especially the internationalist groups. You know, they want to create resentment of Muslims for these countries like Kenya and so on, and Ethiopia, which would lead to more support for their cause. So that's the danger with the current Ethiopian integration into AMISOM. At the same time, as I mentioned earlier, there's, you know, it's balanced by this other issue, which is that the continued intransigence of al-Shabaab in many parts of southern Somalia is likely to lead to another famine. And therefore, it seems to me that AMISOM and the African Union leaders have made this Faustian bargain. You know what? You know, they're caught within a rock and a hard place, and the decision was to integrate Ethiopia. But like I said earlier, this has been going on for a while. You know, Ethiopian troops, more than 4,000 troops, have made incursions inside Somalia several times, especially in that western region. They're simply formalizing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it sounds like I guess it's just proven again that the biggest threat to regular people is being caught between the terrorists and the government, because if, as you say, which I think you're right, that most terrorist acts are meant toward provoking an overreaction, the 99 times out of 100 or more probably, any government in question, you know, ex-government, would love the opportunity to overreact, no matter what the excuse is, in order to expand their power. So these guys can just go back and forth, you know, ultimately until the empire's completely bankrupt and it all falls apart, you know, and the rest of us, the Somalis will starve to death. The Americans, we don't have it quite that bad, but we have to suffer. Well, I guess some Americans are starving over it. We have to suffer a lot of consequences ourselves, but our government is really, you know, we always argue about whether it's stupidity or the plan. All of our government's terrible policies seem to benefit them, if not the national interest, incidentally. Right. So, I think they maybe they're stupid, but they're stupid in their own special ways that benefit themselves a lot of the time.
Yeah, of course. They make these decisions that benefit their donors. You know, I mean, war is business. At the end of the day, war is great business. Some people are making great money We're not just talking about the American corporations here that make the weapons and the guns and the bombs and the jet fighters and so on, but also locally, in Iraq, in Somalia, and elsewhere, there are people who are laughing all the way to the bank.
Yep. Afraid so. All right, and I'm also afraid that I blew this break and we're way over time here, but thank you so much for your time on the show today, Francis. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that is Francis Nesbitt. He is a professor in San Diego at San Diego State University Department of Africana Studies there. And sorry, here's the news. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And hey, check it out. Lucky, happy, wish, last-minute addition to the show. It's Scott McConnell, founding editor of the American Conservative Magazine. Welcome back to the show. Scott, how are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing good, Scott.
Good, good. I'm very happy to talk to you again. And I was very happy to read this article. A lot's been written about the Iran... Isn't that just nice to say? Just right there. A lot has been written about the Iran sanctions and the push by the Israel lobby to get them through the Senate, especially there, and the fact that the president won and they had to back down. And yet your retelling of the saga certainly, I think, is the most thorough. And then also you have a lot to say about it, analysis and opinion-wise. But if you could just catch people up on, first of all, what the hell's AIPAC and what's this big fight that they lost. The headline at the American Conservative Magazine reads, "Victory over AIPAC, what it means and what it doesn't." So just catch us up.
Let's start with the election of President Rouhani in Iran, who was clearly more moderate than his predecessor and made clear that he wanted to negotiate an end to Iran's international isolation and end to economic sanctions. And Iranian diplomats had been talking more intensely to American diplomats beginning in the summer and the fall, negotiating a preliminary deal which would involve Iran more intense inspection of Iran's nuclear program and some limited lifting of international sanctions. And this deal, the preliminary deal, seemed to promise a more kind of broader détente, something analogous to Nixon in China in the early 70s. And we're still a long way away from that. But there are a lot of people who think that Obama wanted that as a goal. They wanted to end the ramp down the American hostility to Iran. And Rouhani's election amplified that opportunity. And there had been negotiations which, Germany, France, China, Russia, and Great Britain, the P5 plus one, went on pretty intensely during the fall. And they were moderately successful. So finally, in around Thanksgiving time, a preliminary deal was signed. And immediately, Netanyahu denounced it, and so did many ministers in the Israeli government, and so did the American right, particularly the neoconservatives, but Republicans in general, as if they, did not want any negotiation with Iran. Netanyahu said it was a very, very bad deal. He promised to send Israeli ministers over to lobby Congress to essentially block the deal, and to get Congress to put so many conditions on Obama to prevent him from negotiating.
Can you elaborate a little bit there about the people he sent to Capitol Hill and what it was that they did, the ones that came from Israel, not just from AIPAC there?
Well, yeah, Naftali Bennett, who is he's an American-born, but he's now a major Israeli right-wing politician, and he's in the government. He came over, and he spent, you know, 3 or 4 days talking to, AIPAC-friendly congressmen and senators. And, boy, you're going to get me. There was another minister-level guy whose name is escapes me right now. But there were two people who were actual ministers in the Israeli government who came over. And they tried to, rile up the troops, saying that this deal is, going to be terrible for Israel and terrible for the Mideast, and Iran's going to get nuclear weapons, and Iran's going to take over the Middle East, and et cetera, et cetera.
And the reason I brought that part up was because one of these congressmen or one of these senators was saying, yeah, I talked to John Kerry and all of that, but I talk with the Israelis about the truth about Iran's nuclear program over there, and I think I'll go with the Israelis. Is it Mark Kirk?
Mark, yeah. Well, Kirk is, traditionally the senator from AIPAC, and before he was a senator, he was a congressman from AIPAC, and he has some very AIPAC-friendly staffers, so even when he's out of commission, because he had a major stroke recently, his office acts as if it's, AIPAC Central. And he did. And the specific disagreement was that Israel was saying that Iran was going to get $40 or $50 billion in sanctions relief, and the administration was making a much lower figure. And I think the administration was right. But you do have senators who were much more willing to accept Israel's word on these things than that of the administration.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm sorry for interrupting there, but I thought that point was worth going into a little bit more depth on there.
Well, so where was I? So eventually, it wasn't clear whether before the Christmas recess there would be a bill, and Harry Reid, who was using the Senate rules to kind of slow things down, because the administration certainly didn't want any legislation that would limit its ability to negotiate. And but finally, at the last minute, there was a bill sponsored initially by Menendez of New Jersey and Mark Kirk and Charles Schumer, which stipulated that the final result of negotiations must be that Iran would have no nuclear enrichment capacity at all, and that promised that the United States would support Israel if Israel felt, for reasons of its own need for self-defense, to attack Iran. It promised American support. So the bill essentially farmed out a major decision about war and peace to another country. The bill did say the United States, in accordance with its constitutional obligations. So it wasn't an automatic declaration of war on Israel's behalf, but it did commit the United States to going to war on Israel's behalf if Israel started a war, and some other things. And the thing about AIPAC bills is, for most senators, it's a no-brainer to sign them. Famously, there was an AIPAC staffer who told Jeffrey Goldberg, by way of illustration, about 10 years ago, he says, "See this napkin? If you want, I could get 70 senators to sign it within 24 hours, meaning, you could get a veto-proof majority for anything AIPAC wanted, just because senators know that, if you're one of your main concerns, if your senator is to get elected and to get reelected, to do whatever is most important to you, staying on the good side of AIPAC is what you do. It's just like normal. But in this case, and the only time I can previously think that AIPAC ever lost the legislative battle was in the early 80s. Ronald Reagan wanted to sell some radar planes to Saudi Arabia, and AIPAC opposed it. And Reagan, he had the military-industrial complex, Lockheed or whoever made the planes on his side, and he was able to prevail. But other than that, AIPAC always wins. But this time it didn't win. the number of senators who signed on the bill. First it was 20, then it was 40, and then it seemed to slow down. And after the Christmas recess, there were some major stories saying that the AIPAC numbers seemed to have stalled. And then there was, you know, by that time there was a fairly large coalition of political forces, large by, you know, inside the Beltway standards, that were opposing this. And in the end, it included major newspapers and, you know, some major TV personalities, such as Chris Hayes and especially Jon Stewart. And the bill got the support of, they got almost all the Republicans except for Ron Paul and Jeff Flake, but they got, you know, no more than 15 Democrats. And some major kind of veteran senators, I think Dianne Feinstein in particular, but also Carl Levin, spoke out in really well-informed ways against this bill. And, I mean, for Feinstein, who's like 80 years old, and she gave this, you know, this really wonderful speech in mid-January, and it's, I mean, she has a, she's this pretty charismatic figure. I think it was an historical event. And so what happened essentially was that AIPAC was exposed as, you know, in, you know, A, losing a battle with the administration. Secondly, not speaking for the mainstream of the American Jewish community, which is, you know, traditionally it had always been the assumption that most Jews support AIPAC and that those who didn't were, you know, very liberal or left-wing.
All right, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to stop you here, Scott, and we'll have to save third and fourth lessons learned and the rest till after this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Scott McConnell, founding editor of the American Conservative magazine. That's theamericanconservative.com. Victory over AIPAC, what it means, what it doesn't. Give me just a sec. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Scott McConnell from the American Conservative magazine about his new piece, Victory Over AIPAC, what it means and what it doesn't. And we're talking about, well, I guess right before the break there, we were at sort of the coalition of people in and outside of the government and so-called civil society and so forth, and I guess the shifting in civil society away from AIPAC's position, and then what turned out to be their somewhat easy defeat, and then, you know, what can be learned from that? Are they just a paper tiger, Scott? Is that the point?
Well, I don't think they're a paper tiger. I wouldn't even characterize the defeat as easy, because a lot of things had to round up the right way, AIPAC is still going to be around and is still going to be pushing Israel's perspective on the United States, including on these Iran negotiations. And the second stage of the negotiations haven't even really begun. So there's plenty of opportunity for AIPAC mischief making. And also, I would say that AIPAC's defeat, which is, I think, terribly significant, but it doesn't mean that the organization doesn't have a lot of power inside the Beltway, and it certainly has a lot of power to prevent America from pushing Israel to make peace with the Palestinians in a reasonable way. That's something I think an American president like Obama can decide that not having a war with Iran is a, you know, absolutely vital American interest, and he's going to fight AIPAC and Israel's ability to push us around on that. But on another issue, like does Israel keep the West Bank or does it withdraw, I don't see Obama or other mainstream Democrats willing to expend as much political capital on that. I mean, this was a question of potentially of war and peace, and I don't think Americans see Israel like that. So I think APAC will still be a big factor on American Mideast policy. Sad to say from my perspective, but I think that's where we are.
Well, Scott, I wouldn't want to give Obama too much credit as a diplomatic this or that, but this did occur to me back at the time when Obama, I forget the footnote now, but I think it was pretty credibly reported that the White House specifically asked APAC to help them convince Congress on the Syria issue. And then, but at the same time, it seemed obvious to me that Obama didn't really want to do the war anyway and took every out that he could to get out of launching the war. And I wonder if, I don't know, for some reason I want to like a president. It's weird. But I sort of think, I wonder whether he did that to them, just ha-ha suckers, just to draw them out and have them suffer another defeat after Hagel, which was a pretty big defeat a year ago, on Syria, so as to weaken their position going into these Iran negotiations. What do you think of that?
Well, I guess it's possible. I've heard that before, and it's really Machiavellian, i.e., I want you to be my ally for a fight that I know you can't win. And then, you know, it gets sort of tricky, because what would have happened if Russia hadn't sort of said, well, you know, we'll help you get rid of the chemical weapons? And that seemed, it all seemed kind of random. Maybe. But
well,
it's just
speculation anyway. I'm sorry to even ask you to speculate. That ain't right.
But I think Obama has felt that he could challenge AIPAC and should challenge AIPAC. I mean, first on the Hagel nomination, where AIPAC lobbied but didn't go all out, and then on Syria, where whether they would get to a congressional vote was kind of, it never got to term. I mean, and then this, where AIPAC clearly lost, this is three defeats for AIPAC. And it's, you know, I'm not a huge, huge fan of J Street, but I certainly respect the organization. And their existence, their presence on the Hill saying, you know, AIPAC doesn't speak for us, we're Zionists, we love Israel, but we don't like Netanyahu, and we don't want war with Iran, and their readiness to back up the administration, you know, counts for a lot. And so I really have to give them credit.
Now, what do you think are the chances for a final deal? Because I guess, well, I hate something by Eli Lake, but I think it was Lake that said that, well, they're still just gearing up for the final negotiation. And I think this was the, and other things that you mentioned earlier, was the demand that Iran's nuclear program cease to exist, at least certainly no enrichment anywhere on Iranian soil. Been the Security Council position and certainly the Israeli position up until now. So do you think Obama's really going to fight it out and kick their ass on this and get it done?
I think he is, and I think that it's not really the Security Council position. I mean, the Security Council position was that Iran would halt enrichment or suspend it, but the people, who have signed on to the interim deal, which implicitly, not explicitly, but implicitly acknowledges Iranian enrichment, and which, you know, are Security Council members, so you can just as well say that that's the P5 plus one position is the Security Council position, I think. That could be argued, I think, reasonably.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And I think Kerry has certainly, I mean, he has said there's no right for Iran to enrich, but also I think everybody who's negotiating knows that, you know, no Iranian government could survive that completely gave up. I mean, Iran has put so much money and effort and suffered so much on behalf of trying to, you know, enrich uranium that they're not going to just give it up. And there's more and more people in the Israeli national security apparatus who sort of give hints that, you know, yes, Israel could, you know, choke down an arrangement in which Iran still enriches uranium. It's going to be a tough negotiation because there are, I mean, obviously very hardline factions in Iran too, as in the United States. I mean, my fantasy is you could take, you know, all the Revolutionary Guards and then the Mark Kirk and AIPAC and put them all on a desert island and they can fight it out. But there are significant political factors in Iran, including, from what I can see, like half the Iranian parliament, who doesn't want any negotiation with the great Satan. And they actually, you know, maybe economically benefit in some way from the sanctions regime and would feel that they would be politically lose from a liberalization which brought Iran back into the world economy. Mm-hmm. And so they are attacking Rouhani and his foreign minister Zarif as sellouts, like, all the time. So
That's such a great point. I mean, is such an important reason why not to do the sanctions in the first place, because then you just turn the whole oil black market over to the Revolutionary Guards, and you just entrench day by day, month by month, you just entrench their interest in keeping things this way.
Mm-hmm.
Madness. These are the diplomats. These are the experts. They know just what to do.
But, you know, so I think the negotiation will be difficult, but I would say, you know, I would bet like 70% that a deal which, you know, in which the Iranian nuclear program is slowed down and subject to inspections, so we know that they're not going to, you know, run and build a bomb next month or something like that, and which provides a long breathing period in which the Iranians can decide and we can decide whether we can be, you know, have a more cooperative and normal relationship. I would say it's a 70% chance that that'll happen, yeah.
Yeah. All right, now, I know everybody wouldn't agree, but I think you might agree that Israel's Palestinian occupation there ranks right up there somewhere near the Iran issue as far as America's national security interests over there. You know, after all, the 9/11 attackers cited American support for Israel's occupation as one of their primary motivations for crashing into our towers in the first place. So, and it seems like if a president is willing to defy Netanyahu's Likud government defy AIPAC over this Iran thing, if he's got the power, why not go ahead and get him to end the occupation of the West Bank? After all, as everyone knows, the status quo, since time keeps moving forward, ends really badly for Israel. So, you know, Netanyahu's a kook. Obama knows better than Netanyahu what's best for Israel anyway. Why doesn't he just go ahead and make him do the right thing and end the occupation?
Well, it's a question of how much political capital he would have to spend to do that and whether it gets in the way of goals which are more important to him. Obama may think, look, if Israel wants to become unambiguously before the world, you know, present itself as an apartheid state, which is what will happen, and what will be clear to everybody if it doesn't withdraw from the West Bank, you know, he may just think, well, if they want to do that to themselves, you know, I can't stop them. You know, it's just like they made it too hard. Obama made a pretty significant effort to stop Israeli settlement building and, you know, get Israel to pull back early in his term. And he just, you know, Netanyahu came and basically took his head off. And the American, and Netanyahu was more popular in the American Senate than Obama was in 2009 and 2010. And I think Obama could see that his whole presidency threatened by a war with Netanyahu that, you know, he didn't really need. My sense is that Obama's view is it would be nice. If Israel wants to make peace, he will help them, and he will push them to negotiation. But if Israel wants to keep being an occupying power and eventually face a much broader and probably European-centered boycott and sanctions movement, you know, that's their problem. You know, he's done what he can. I mean, I Obama might not say that himself, but that's my interpretation of where he is at.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? This is all the predictable result back in 2009 when he was talking so big and yet wasn't willing to back it up with any threat of withholding aid whatsoever. Yeah. And without that,
you know, all it is talk in the face of an Israeli government that just will not budge, no matter what you call them, no matter what you say about them. So it is what it is, I guess. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. I enjoyed it.
All right, everybody. That is Scott McConnell. He's the founding editor at the American Conservative magazine. That's theamericanconservative.com. And this piece is really good. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Victory over AIPAC. What it means, what it doesn't. TheAmericanConservative.com. Back after this with Andy Worthington. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I won't be here tomorrow because I'll be hopping on a plane to Washington, D.C. I'm giving a speech at the Future Freedom Foundation Conference within a conference at the International Students for Liberty Conference at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Washington this Saturday. It's going on Saturday and Sunday, but yeah. And Oliver Stone's going to be there, and Jeremy Scahill, and Stephen Kinzer, and Robert Higgs, and Sheldon Richmond, and it's going to be awesome. Jeff Tucker's going to be there. All kinds of great folk are going to be there, and so it's going to be great. That's in D.C. this weekend, if you're not too snowed in. Hope to see you there. All right, good. So, speaking of the Future Freedom Foundation, Andy Worthington writes for them from time to time, maybe even a bit more often than that. They're at fff.org. Andy's blog is at andyworthington.co.uk, and, of course, he's the author of the book The Guantanamo Files, and he's the director-producer of the movie Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, Scott. Yeah, nice to be back talking to you.
Good. I'm happy to have you here. So, Guantanamo's still open, and I guess it was noted in the news the other day. Well, you know, of course, Obama paid some lip service in the State of the Union. Never mind that. It was noted the other day that it's the anniversary, the 12th anniversary of the Bush administration's abandonment of the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah.
So, what's the big deal?
Well, you know, when you when you're at war, Scott, and you decide to hold people, take them off the battlefield, there are two things that you're supposed to do. One is that you're supposed to ascertain whether you have the right people, which the Bush administration decided they didn't want to do. The way of doing that is that if they're not wearing military uniforms, then you hold Article 5 tribunals close to the time and place of capture to find out whether you've got civilians or combatants. The U.S. did that in the first Gulf War and held about 1,200 tribunals, and in 900 cases realized they got the wrong people and sent them home. So they didn't do that. They just rounded everybody up and said, we're going to have you anyway. And then they refused to allow them to be held as prisoners of war with all the protections of the Geneva Conventions. And the baseline protection of the Geneva Convention, Scott, is that you are not allowed to torture or abuse the people in your control. So by not doing that, President Bush was making it clear, really, that no rules applied to these men and that therefore the United States could do anything it wanted with them. And pretty soon, of course, what happened was that they started torturing them.
Yep, by the tens of thousands. Anyway, we'll get to that in just a second. But the thing of it is, isn't it correct? Is this the memo that says, yeah, but the Taliban, they didn't sign the Geneva Convention, so screw them. Isn't that the law? If they didn't sign it, then we don't have to abide by it either.
Well, this is the race to the bottom theory of international treaties. You know, it doesn't really matter, Scott, who you're up against. And the way they behave, if you don't adhere to the rules that you say are important and that are the kind of things that keep us away from being from descending into barbarism, then you descend into barbarism. So you know, I mean, I think that's really one of the things that happened after 9/11. Most fundamentally, you know, when the gloves came off and Dick Cheney, you know, was there boasting about how we were going to have to go to the dark side. You know, what does it mean, the dark side, Dick? Well, that means, you know, a place where we torture people, where we hold people indefinitely without charge or trial, where we disappear people, where we set up networks of secret prisons to torture people, where we, you know, we arrange for other countries to host these prisons for us because we can't do it ourselves, because it's illegal, all of this. And, you know, what is the difference between this and a fully functioning, nasty, totalitarian place? Well, I don't think there is any, really, is there?
Right. Well, and then the other thing is, too, is the dark side means we're making up all the rules as we go along, and since they're all a bunch of nitwits, they end up ruining everything. And so, and they turn their own empire into a laughing stock. I mean, it's kind of a bitter chuckle, but everybody in the whole world knows that Guantanamo is full and has always been full of a bunch of nobodies, a big publicity stunt of how evil America is. What the hell is that supposed to prove?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, what amazes me after all this amount of time, Scott, is that people really don't get that. You know, that this is a place that is
I meant to say 6.5 billion people in the world get it. The Americans don't count, but everybody else in the world knows. From, you know,
well, you know, but I mean, it's interesting because partly, obviously, you're right. You know, this place is for show, and people should realize that you know, that a bunch of people are being victimized for that purpose, for scaring people, for putting up a front. But it's also a place where, you know, most crucially, people who, you know, with a very small exception, a very small number of people are an exception to this, but the majority of the people held at Guantanamo, you know, throughout its history have been in two camps. Either completely innocent people in the wrong time and place, you know, many of whom were sold because the Americans were offering bounty payments, huge bounty payments. But let's say the bulk of the people that were held were soldiers. They were in Afghanistan, they were involved with the Taliban one way or another, or militarily or in a support way, fighting the Northern Alliance before the 9/11 attacks. That then, you know, they then became involved in the in a conflict with the United States after the United States invaded. And yet, you know, the shorthand for these guys for all of these 12 years that this nonsense has been going on is that they're terrorists. We have all been played by the Bush administration, and Obama hasn't done enough to get rid of this notion that actually people who are fighting against us are terrorists. There appears to be no such thing anymore as soldiers. What we're up against are insurgents, and insurgents are terrorists. So, you know, that's what I find really disappointing. You know, we've got a bunch of guys in Guantanamo been there for 12 years, longer than the First World War and the Second World War put together. We still have, you know, major players in the United States political scene who want to hold these guys forever, and yet they were never anybody in the first place. They were guys who, you know, at the best were part of some long-forgotten military conflict that had nothing to do with America before the 9/11 attacks. It's ridiculous.
Right. Well, and that's the whole thing, too, is they weren't even insurgents. They were the government of Afghanistan, almost all of it, and the terror there, or the foot soldiers of it, and the terrorists were the commie Northern Alliance that, you know, America came and ended up backing, that were on the verge of total defeat at the time of the 9/11 attacks and the American intervention over there. So they weren't even really, you know, unlawful enemy belligerents or whatever kind of you know, technicality. They were actually just foot soldiers of a government, one admittedly that the American government, you know, bombed and replaced, but still.
Yeah. At that time, anyway,
I'm not saying that would really, I don't think that definition might, or maybe it would count again now, but say a couple of years ago, you could get away with saying the Taliban is the insurgency and not the dominant force in the country or something like that.
Right.
But not back then. Anybody who was arrested back in the fall of 01, they were the foot soldier of the government that was being defeated. So that makes them maybe a POW, but it doesn't make them a terrorist at all.
No, absolutely. But, you know, but that is the Alice through the looking glass world that we've ended up in the last 12 years. Yeah. Is that, you know, things that made sense and were logical and you know, and had a sense of proportion about them 12 years ago have gone out the window. And you know, and as I say, Scott, I find it depressing that far too many people don't realise that what's happened. I mean, they're content to do what the government tells them, which is to look the other way, and to believe them when they say, you know, these are the bad guys. You don't really need to know anything more than that.
Right. All right. Now, hey, in the last couple of minutes of this segment, maybe we can get one more question too. But could you talk a little bit more about those Article 5? I forget, that's the Geneva Convention, Article 5 mandates, but then there's military law that outlines how a military commission is supposed to work in the battlefield. This isn't, guilt or innocence. This is, do we care about you at all to hold you, or do we turn you loose because you're nobody? And you were saying that worked really well in the first Gulf War, and that was the process that, you know, I guess has been developed since the American Revolution, which Donald Rumsfeld threw out the window in favor of pay the Pakistanis bounties for as many, you know, people as they can turn over to us.
Yeah, well, they were called competent tribunals. I mean, sometimes they get referred to as battlefield tribunals, and they are specifically for making sure that if you're dealing with a non-straightforward military conflict, i.e. you haven't got two bunches of guys out on a field both wearing uniforms and carrying national flags. But when it's slightly more irregular than that, that you're prone to make mistakes. You know, there's a guy wheeling a cart full of his farming stuff through the middle of a conflict zone, and you pick him up, and he says, "No, guys, I'm a farmer." And you know, you hold these tribunals to find out whether that's the case or not. You know, it's amazing the results from Iraq, where nearly 3 out of 4 cases, they held these tribunals, they got the wrong people, they sent them home. You know, you can see why Guantanamo is full of nobodies, literally full of nobodies, when you extrapolate those kind of figures, 3 out of 4, to Guantanamo. And, you know, and that pretty broadly fits with the kind of nonsense that was going on in that place, that these were people who, had there been that type of screening which had been pioneered by the U.S., they would never have ended up being sent there in the first place. You know, and these are the guys that, you know, Dunleavy, who was the one of the early commanders of Guantanamo, you know, referred to that, you know, he was annoyed at the number of Mickey Mouse detainees who were being sent to Guantanamo from Afghanistan.
Right, yeah, and of course, you know, people might think now, well, yeah, but Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is there and all that, but they weren't even brought there until the CIA prisons were shut down, at least as far as we know, back in 2005. Before that, it was nothing but nobodies, right? They finally brought some guilty people just to dress the damn thing up.
Well, a few years ago, I spoke to Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, and he told me exactly that. He said, you know, that this is the thing, really, is that, you know, when they moved these guys to Guantanamo in September 2006, it's so they could actually say, hey, well, you know, we've got some terrorists in Guantanamo, because before that they didn't.
Right, that was Colin Powell's right-hand man there. He was the Secretary of State at the time, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's told me on this show before that he would be perfectly happy. Years ago, he told me he'd be perfectly happy to testify against Dick Cheney in front of the grand jury for the torture spree back then. And we'll get back and talk a little bit more about Guantanamo. Well, a lot more about Guantanamo and torture and the rest of it with our friend Andy Worthington, andyworthington.co.uk. Back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, all right. Here's one of my favorite George W. Bush clips ever, everybody. Turn down this Dresden 45% here.
And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague.
Yeah, poor guy. That's after the Hamdan decision that said that, no, the president does not have the authority to suspend participation in the Geneva Conventions, and they do apply. And it's funny that Bush's complaint there is that, oh, come on, no outrages upon human dignity. That could mean anything. And we get all this stuff that we like doing to these people. And what's funny about it is he's right that it's vague, but it's written like that deliberately, of course, to be all-inclusive. If you think it might be over the line, you cannot do it to your detainee. Get it? That's the point. And poor Bush is saying, oh, come on. I mean, that includes things that are only half torture and two-thirds torture, too. And an outrage upon human dignity. I like outraging human dignity. Anyway, so that's his game. And so at some point, they finally did stop torturing people, but not before tens of thousands were tortured. And this is a little bit off of just the Guantanamo beat, Andy, but I know you're, you know, well aware of all this history and the so-called legalities behind it and the rest of it. But ultimately, somewhere around tens of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans were tortured in those wars. And basically what happened was the legal theory from Afghanistan and from Guantanamo Bay kind of just filtered its way through different chains of command into the battlefield in Iraq, where then any Iraqi resistance fighter all of a sudden was under the same rules as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in, you know, over there near the Durrán line, you know, fighting it out with bin Laden. And so what they ended up doing, it was, you know, during the entire occupation of Afghanistan, well, and particularly Iraq, it was just completely lawless. And as Tony Lugaranis put it to PBS Frontline, he said, look, we torch them on the side of the road. We torch them in their front yard, in their living room, and in their backyard, and in front of their wives, and in front of their kids. And sometimes we killed them. And you want to know how we tortured them? We tortured them this way and that, electrified cages, and, you know, whatever crazy stuff they could come up with. And not all just, you know, top-down CIA-type torture, but just the average grunt out on patrol was told the same rules as the CIA and special forces in Afghanistan, was that grab whom you must, do what you want, the gloves are off. All these people knocked down the towers, man. Just go out there and get them. And so tens of thousands of people were tortured. And meanwhile, the American people, I think if you surveyed them, would say, well, yeah, I heard that they dunked one guy underwater three times or something like that. When this was a gigantic regime of torture on a massive scale and for years on end. And then, you know, sometimes they'll maybe mention the outsourcing of torture to the Badr Brigade in Iraq and that kind of thing. But, you know, that's only the fringes of the discussion, if you ask me. The center of it is the top-down regime from the president, the vice president, and all the way through the intelligence services and the military. And I guess that's what the 6,000-page torture report that they just won't release is about, because they're afraid that if the American people really had any idea what was in there, that this would be enough maybe to bring those Republicans back to D.C. for, you know, to Virginia for trial.
Very well put, Scott. You know, there is one thing that I should add to that, which is that on the very same day that George Bush stood in the White House Rose Garden saying, you know, we... You know those secret prisons that I told you we didn't have? Well, we did, but we've closed them, and now we're sending those guys to Guantanamo, these 14 high-value detainees. The very day that he announced that the black sites were closing, the Army Field Manual was reissued containing an appendix called Appendix M, which I encourage listeners to look up, Appendix M of the Army Field Manual. It contains a list of torture techniques which can be approved for use by high-up officials when it's called for. It's not specified when it will be used, but it's basically as soon as the torture program came to an end, it migrated to an appendix of the Army Field Manual so that it can continue in some form or another. You know, we certainly don't see that it's on the same massive industrial scale as it was when those two hideous wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were at maximum impact. And as you've so well expressed, Scott, you know, 10,000s of people were tortured who had nothing to do with anything. But it's still there. It's still there as you know, as an official part of U.S. policy.
Well, man, I want somebody to WikiLeak that Senate report, because that 6,000-page report, I mean, after look, it was put together by Dianne Feinstein's staff, and, you know, she's actually been pretty good on the torture issue. I don't know every detail. There may be caveats to that going back, but lately anyway. But you can't expect her staff to really tell you everything you need to know. This is would still be, if not a whitewash, a very mainstream Senate committee version of what happened, but still they are scared to death of releasing this thing, and they claim they're quibbling about some details of fact here or there, but it's the release of the entire report, which I guess some who have seen it are saying that this is like the Pentagon Papers of the torture program. Man, there's so much in here. You know, I guess it could really take over the entire political discussion for a little while, like the NSA stuff, and they're just scared to
24
death
24 hours maybe.
I mean, can you imagine turning Marcy Wheeler loose on a 6,000-page report like that?
I mean, no one will, people will read the press release, and they'll talk about it for 24 hours, and then Kim Kardashian will be wearing a new top. Oh, yeah. You know how it goes.
That's quite true. I hate to overstate it.
The evidence is already out there. You know, people can have a look at the CIA Inspector General report from 2004, which was finally released years ago. Mm-hmm. They can have a look at the Senate's report into detainee treatment. That was the Senate Armed Service Committee's report into detainee treatment, which came out 2009, I think. It was the very end of the Bush administration, actually. That's a 300-and-something page analysis of how exactly the systematic torture of prisoners developed. It's an absolutely fantastic document. You know, this is all public knowledge. You know, the sad thing is that the case for the indictment of the senior Bush administration officials and their lawyers and everybody else who helped, you know, is actually out there. The problem, of course, is that, you know, there's no willingness in the corridors of power to pursue it. That said, I would dearly love to see this report and as unredacted as possible.
Yeah, well, good luck to us all on that. I don't know. I mean, hey, these are the days of WikiLeaks, and it can be done. I mean, look at what Edward Snowden got away with downloading and liberating for the people. So somebody's cousin is a staffer on that Senate committee can give us that thing. Put it on the Pirate Bay. Come on. All right. And now there's another thing I wanted to ask you here real quick at the end was about the hunger strike and how many people are still on it and how's it going and what's being done about it.
Well, the last I've heard, Scott, is that Shaka Arma, the last British guy in Guantanamo, has said that there are 34 guys on a hunger strike now. 17 of them are being force-fed. And, you know, that's just an increase of one from a report from him from about a month ago. So, you know, it's not taking off in a major way, but that's still a significant number of people. And, of course, you know, the horrible thing is that for the guys who are being force-fed, they're strapped down to the restraint chair twice a day and the tubes pumped up through their nose and, you know, and it's a pretty disgusting process. Shaka Arma and a couple of other prisoners have a long-standing legal challenge from last summer in which they're trying to get judges to tell the government that they're not allowed to force-feed them, which the district court had to turn down because of a legal precedent, you know, whereby Congress told the courts, you know, anything to do with the treatment of prisoners in the war on terror is not for us to interfere with. But they appealed to the D.C. Circuit Court, a formerly notoriously right-wing court that seems to be mellowing slightly these days. Judges there heard the case in the fall and have just delivered a ruling saying that although they can't order the government to stop force-feeding the prisoners, they think that there is enough to the case to send it back down to the district court for them to have further investigations into what the rights of prisoners are, the extent to which prisoners may be able to challenge the ways in which they're treated by the government. So, you know, this is all seems very abstract, and it's not led to any anything immediate, but legally it's actually quite significant that judges in the generally known as the Conservative Court of Appeals are actually saying, you know, I think we need some oversight here on the way that, prisoners are being treated. So, you know, there's progress there. The main area that we're looking for progress in, though, Scott, is that, you know, since the big hunger strike last year that forced President Obama's hand, he said, I'm going to start releasing prisoners, I'm going to appoint some envoys, we're going to have some movement here. Well, yeah, we have had some movement. He has released 11 men. There are 155 men still in Guantanamo, and 77 of those men are men who have been cleared for release, all but one of them over 4 years ago when Obama's interagency task force reviewed the cases and said, look, these are guys that we don't want to put on trial and that we don't want to carry on holding. These are guys that, you know, we want out of here, and yet they're still held there. So we're waiting for action from President Obama. More than 11 men. We want all the rest of these people to be released. And what people really need to be aware of is that the majority of these 77 men, 56 of them, are Yemenis. And no Yemenis have been released from Guantanamo for years. And, you know, because Yemen is regarded as a nation that's a host of terrorism.
Yeah, well, they're afraid of the headline, the politics of the headline.
To get over themselves. And release prisoners to Yemen. It's time for this.
We gotta go. I'm
to
sorry.
To an end.
Thanks so much, Andy Worthington.co.uk. Thanks, Andy.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. Bye.